Well, good morning, Palmer. This is the Mike and Dave show on the this Wednesday morning, and we're going to start out with a great opportunity. We have with us a guest, Rachel. Can you hear us?
I can indeed.
Good. Well, Rachel, is it Kleinfeld?
Yes.
Is the president and chief executive officer of the Truman Project, and where are you calling in from?
I'm in Colorado today.
In Colorado, we are so pleased to have you. Tell us a little bit about the Truman Project.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me on your show. You know, I'm from Fairbanks, so I love to do anything that gets me back into Alaska. But we got started about 7 years ago, basically, when we saw that the country was moving in a very dangerous direction from a national security perspective. We thought that both parties didn't have it very right, but that at the time the Bush administration was leading us in a pretty dangerous direction that didn't really understand the security issues of the 21st century and what we needed to do to keep America safe and build a stable world. So we wanted to create a generation of national security experts, political leaders, policy leaders who understood the threats of today and could figure out what tools America needed to address them and stay a strong country.
Wow. So you basically you saw a problem with how we were handling national security, and your response to the problem was an educational response, trying to develop the talent to respond to this issue. Is that right? Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly right. You know, it takes a long time to create a national security professional, and most of the people that we had been created when the Cold War was going on and the Soviet Union was our big threat. So the way they saw the world was through that lens, and that made a lot of sense, and they were very good at what they did. But suddenly we had issues like cybersecurity or biological terrorism, or terrorism, period, which is not done by a country. It's done by individuals or groups. And people who were trained under that old system didn't really understand how the new system worked, and so we needed to train a new group.
Hmm. So what's different about the way you respond or be proactive in a world where the players, in the Cold War, where the players were nation states, and now where they are independent individuals and groups? What changes?
Well, a lot of it is common sense, to be honest, but the government is not always organized to change fast enough, so it has trouble doing it. For instance, if you have a lot of people in a lot of different countries who might individually be going onto websites, logging in, and getting excited about terrorist propaganda, uh-huh. Well, then you need people trained in going onto those websites and changing that propaganda, attacking it, and so on. You also need people who look like the people in those groups to infiltrate those groups and, from an intelligence standpoint, try to take them out, not necessarily through violence, but just through breaking up the organizations. Mm-hmm. But our intelligence networks had screening processes where, frankly, if you weren't a native-born Caucasian American who had never done anything wrong in your entire life, it was very hard to get into the intelligence agencies. And so we didn't have people who looked Pakistani. We didn't have people who looked Yemeni or what have you, because they couldn't make it through our procedures. If they had family from those countries, they couldn't be intelligence agencies. Well, we were just cutting off our nose to spite our face. We couldn't get into those groups.
Mm-hmm.
Same with internet ability. We didn't necessarily have people who had that because our computer systems were so secure that many of them weren't even connected to the internet until about the year 2000 in government. And so you had a lot of people in government who weren't very good at the internet as a result. It made sense. They wanted to keep their information secure. But
sure,
the end result was not very helpful to fighting today's threats.
But, and ironic, since the internet came out of those government institutions.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What about this whole thing about And this is a question that maybe justice maybe hasn't changed since the Cold War, but soft power versus hard power, is it that you some people are hawks and some people are doves, and then some people know that this is the time to be a hawk and this is the time to be a dove, or is there a change in that balance that needs to happen?
You know, if I can fight the question a little bit, I think that I know those terms have become very popular, but frankly, there's just power. Power is getting people to do what you want them to do, uh-huh. whether they want to do it or not. And anyone who's trying to wield power, whether you're a boss of a company or a teacher trying to control a classroom or a national security expert, you use a lot of different tools. Sometimes you cajole, sometimes you build friendship, sometimes you use mutual interest, sometimes you use force. You know, a mom or dad does this with their kids. Sometimes the kid goes in a timeout, sometimes you give them a cookie. There's all sorts of different ways that you exercise power. And it's not really soft or hard or strong or weak or doves or hawks. It's just, can you do it well or not? Mm-hmm. In today's world, I think the chances of using military force, there's still a lot of times when you need military force, but not nearly as often for some of the threats that we have. For instance, we're having hacking incidents from Russia, China, different countries like that constantly. They're constantly trying to attack. Well, you know, you don't use military force against hackers on a computer. You use computer offense against them. I was talking with some members of the Rumsfeld Defense Department back when the Bush administration was in power, and I said, you know, they were talking very much about using hard power to go after terrorists. And I said, that makes a lot of sense in places that were at war, or places where we can do that. But a lot of terrorist organizing is happening in London and Germany and parts of Europe. Are we going to bomb London or Germany or parts of Europe? No, it's ridiculous. We have to use many, many tools. That doesn't mean military power is not important. It stays very important. You just need to be sensible and develop as many options as you can to exercise powers in an intelligent way.
And what was their response?
Well, it was actually a pretty disturbing interview. I was talking about Homeland Security. At the time, I was doing a study with a group called the Defense Policy Board that works with the Defense Department, and they were studying how to do information sharing better across our intelligence agencies, because one of the problems with 9/11 had been we hadn't been sharing information across the CIA, the FBI, and so on. And they basically questioned the premise of the study, which was a governmental study, and said we shouldn't be looking so much at defense, we need to be looking at offense, and we should only be going on offense. And they were very, very pro the military solutions, and that was right before the Iraq War, so it's not that surprising. That's how they were looking at it.
Right, and look where that got us.
Well, exactly. One of the problems with blunt instruments is that you have a lot of unintended consequences. So, you know, I worry about the same thing right now with Iran. We certainly don't want them to get a nuclear weapon. That would be extremely problematic. But a war would be worse. Mm-hmm. And so our job as national security experts is to widen the options so we can keep them from getting a bomb, but also not go to war, because a war with a very large country that has terrorist groups that are set to attack Israel, that are set to attack us, that borders Afghanistan, where we still have a lot of troops, you know, you can just see the unintended consequences against us, against Israel, against our troops in the theater in Afghanistan. So you want to do everything you can to avoid that before you use such a blunt option. And I think the last administration was much more quick to go to war, and I think of it as a very important tool, but really it's the last one you want to use.
Okay. All right. Yeah, Mike is here, and he'd like to ask a question.
Sure. Hi there, Rachel. Mike Molesky. I was just wondering, Rachel Maddow has a new book out, Drift, which deals with, in one sense, unintended consequences of changing the way military does things, using private sector, et cetera, or even the question involving moving into unintended places. Do you have any comments about that, or have you looked at it at all, or her concepts?
Well, first of all, Mike, it's great to be on your show, and sadly, I have not read Rachel's book yet. It is on the list, but
right.
The list is long. But to talk about the issues, military contractors who are trigger pullers, the people who are actually shooting other people and so on, that's a real problem. We need to get that. That should really be a governmental function, in my view. It's a very small percentage of overall contractors. What we did when we moved from a draft army in Vietnam or World War II to a professional military was took all the jobs that, peeling potatoes, all the things you see Beetle Bailey doing in the comic strip, all those jobs we outsourced. And so most contractors are providing food, setting up beds, doing laundry, things like that, which is fine. I don't see any problem with that. You want them to be honest. You don't want to have corruption, things like that. But there's no real reason that our highly trained airmen and sailors, Marines, Army should be doing that kind of work. But intelligence, trigger pulling, things like that, possibly translation, those should be governmental functions because you want to be able to have a chain of command. You want to control what people do. You want to have it be very, very clear if someone breaks the rules, what rules they're breaking. And that's a pretty small percentage of the military. Now, that requires us to be aware that that means more money to a military budget. So it's an option that the left and the right don't like. You know, the right wants to expand that budget, but the left doesn't want to expand the military, and the right doesn't want to admit that some of those jobs need to come into the government because they don't want to expand government. So it's a pox on all their houses, but that's what I think needs to happen.
And that's, of course, a question, the interesting question about cost factors, whether it is more efficient, less costly to have the military doing this or private contractors.
Sure, and again, it probably depends on the function. Definitely cheapest is to use what's known as third-party contractors for a lot of these functions. Those are often people from the country themselves, and that has some other good side effects. In a war, one of the things you do is build a bubble economy, but you also hurt the economy of a country. So employing local people to prepare food or to wash clothes, that kind of thing, that builds a lot of goodwill. That's probably a very smart thing to do, and it's cheaper. Whereas, again, your translators, you need to really check them out, and you want to make sure they're being honest. And trigger pullers, you want to make sure they're under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which would require them to be American.
Right.
And talking about dealing with locals, what responsibility do you have when locals are exposing themselves to difficult situations or unsafe situations even after you leave?
You know, I'm so glad you asked that question. People really, they think, oh, America's leaving and that's the end of it, but it's not. In most of these countries, Afghanistan and Iraq, but it happens every time we go to war, people stand up and they believe in the American mission and they say, we want to help. And so we hire them as translators. They build schools. They open women's clinics. They do all sorts of things. And then we leave, and frankly, a lot of them get killed, or they face threats, or they have to become refugees. And that's just wrong. America should not be doing that. It is not right morally. If people are helping us in our war effort, we should be helping them and keeping them safe. It's also not smart strategically, because the more we do this, the less other people trust us. And then they don't raise their hand as much the next time we're in their country. You can see that in Afghanistan. A lot of people would like to help America. When I was there in 2005, that was very clear. But boy, they were hedging their bets. You know, they were waiting to see. So we have a real moral responsibility, and there's a practical reason for it. Right now, we're letting in a very small number of Iraqi refugees. We're very, very careful about Afghan refugees. We're not doing what we should be doing by the men and women who sit up to translate for our troops. And I work a lot with veterans who come back and feel that they're letting down these people that they worked side by side with, and their stories are pretty heartbreaking.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to switch gears, I'd like to hear more about your story, your journey from Fairbanks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now, was it Newsweek magazine or Time that said you were one of the top 40, under 40 people in political science today?
Sure, it was Time magazine. And, you know, it was a wonderful journey. I grew up in Fairbanks and loved Alaska. And like many people, when you leave Alaska, you travel far. And I had the opportunity to travel a lot as a kid, but also I had some amazing experiences in Fairbanks. One of my real good friends was a professor at the University of Alaska who's still there, a guy named Terry Bader, who worked on war crimes issues in El Salvador, later on in East Timor, and the Bosnian War and Kosovo, et cetera, and was very inspiring. And I got to see what could be done by one person who wanted to do the right thing in these very difficult warlike situations. I had a friend who was a Cuban refugee who was a cab driver, and I took classes at the University of Alaska before I was old enough to drive, and he would drive me, and we would talk about Cuba and what was going on there. So just amazing people that I grew up with in Alaska. And when I was pretty young, the University of Alaska took a bunch of students to Russia right after the Soviet Union fell to start a theater, and so I got to go there for a little while, which was a pretty exciting time to be there. And so I caught the bug for doing international relations and went off back east for school and won a Rhodes and got to go to Oxford and spent a lot of time. Once you're over there, you know, once you're in England, it's pretty easy to get to the rest of the world. So I did a lot of travel, spent a lot of time on the ground in countries, and was really hit over the head with the importance of understanding a brand new world. I remember being at a conference for NATO back in the mid-90s, and there were all these new Eastern European countries that wanted to get into NATO. And they said, you know, the Russian mafia is at our heels, our economies are falling apart, we're having lots of problems demographically, a lot of them were shrinking as countries and the aging. We really want to be in NATO. And I thought, you know, NATO is an important alliance, and it's a very worthwhile entity, but NATO can't help you with any of those problems. What can NATO do against the Russian mafia? And so I thought, you know, we need new instruments to deal with the world today, and that sort of set me on my journey.
Hmm. Well, that's amazing and very thought-provoking response there. Mike, do you have any other questions or comments?
Well, we talked about the human factors involved here, and I know that one of the interesting issues over time here has involved the question of the use of drones, because they absolutely have a human impact at the end. And I wondered if you had some comments about the question of command and control of drones, who makes the decision to do what is done when a drone does what a drone does.
You know, we're having a conference about this in a couple of weeks because this is very cutting edge in terms of the security conversation. Right now, we need humans to be in that chain of command and to decide at what point a drone shoots, at what point a drone pulls back. But we don't need them to be in the chain of command technologically. The technology is there to basically let a drone have facial recognition technology, gait recognition technology, know what its target is, and go do its thing. Now, of course, not all drones are killing drones. A lot of drones are intelligence drones. They just collect information. They have cameras and so on. But technologically, there's no need for a human there. Morally, there's a pretty big need for a human there. You know, can you imagine if a drone kill someone and you could say, oh, it's just a glitch in the software, nobody's guilty. Or if a dictator, like what's going on in Syria right now with Assad, sets up a bunch of drones and they kill innocent people and civilians, and the dictator says, oh, you know, we aren't guilty of war crimes because it was the drones, or you can hold this low-level technician who programmed the drones accountable, but not me. Real big moral and legal problems with this and deterrence problems with this. So we've got a conference coming up at the Truman Project with conservatives and progressives, legal scholars, moral scholars, technologists to start figuring out what needs to be done to get our arms around these kinds of new problems.
Okay. Well, it sounds as if you are involved with most of these issues. Where do you spend your time? You're in Colorado now, but do you work out of a particular part of the country?
We're based in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And so that's where my staff are, and that's where our offices are. But I'm not, you know, coming from Alaska, I miss the mountains, so I get out to Colorado as much as I can, and we're a national organization, so we have people that we train who are all over the country. We work with a lot of politicians who are Democrats or progressive, even if they're Republican, who want to understand these new issues. And so we'll train them everywhere. And we do trainings for the West Coast, the Rocky Mountain West, the East Coast, the Midwest, the South. So I spend a lot of the time on the road.
Okay.
Very good.
Do you have a public face or, you know, a listener who might be tuned in today if they wanted to know a bit more, or perhaps could be one of those politicians who'd like to contact you? How would they go about doing that?
Of course. Just go to our website. It's www.trumanproject.org, Truman like the president.
Okay.
We'd love to hear from you. And thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you, Rachel. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with?
I think you guys did a fantastic job. It's one of the more interesting interviews I've ever had, so thank you so much.
Take care.
Well, thank you so much, and we will hopefully keep in touch, and great work.
Absolutely. Well, take care.
Take care. Bye.
Okay, well, David, that was certainly a pleasure.
Yes.
And I'm happy that you arranged to have Rachel call in, and we were able to share that.